Yes, we were using those cement bags from the mine. We torn off the corners and in the middle, and we slipped this underneath of our normal daily prison what we were wearing. And that kept us, this paper bag kept us a little bit warm during the Polish winter. Anyway, so that we were carrying it the day we were evacuated, we had to evacuate the camp. We were actually put together in those rows of five, and we were forced to march through fields and woods because the roads were already overflowing with retreating German army from the front. As I said, it was already the middle of January 1945. And so we were walking through day and nights through really terrible condition, and people were in the back of the road. We had to tow those sleighs with this luggage of the German soldiers, and we couldn't actually. So people were falling, is the last bit of energy they had, were falling, and you could hear in the back, nobody could have been left alive in the back of this marching row of people. Where actually you had shooting, so there were everybody who was left behind were shot, and there was this only one horse powered, one horse powered sleds, where they were loading those dead people, and they had to be buried when somewhere in the snow, when there was already overflowing with people. So we reached on the fifth day. I couldn't actually walk anymore. We had another dogfight of planes above us while we were walking. I think it was the third day that killed also several people because they told us to disperse a little bit along into the field, into the snow. And then when this dogfight of the planes were over, you saw those rows of people who were hit from the machine guns from the plane. They were lying, so they couldn't anymore stand up. So it was really also a terrible time, I can remember. And the fifth day, suddenly we arrived about 10 kilometers from the river Odra, where, as you might remember, that was the last place where the front has stopped and stayed there for several months till the last assault towards Berlin, yes. And so we were there, we were put, the Germans put us for a while, they needed themselves to have a rest there. And so in order to need the smallest amount of people to guard us, so they put us into an empty concentration camp already there, which was in this place. It was called Blackhammer, and there was an enormous factory which was called the Oberschlesische Hebräerwerke. It was still in this coal mine region, and they were making this synthetic petrol out of coal there. And so there were a lot of empty camps around that. And so they put us in this one camp there, and while we were kept there for those few hours, they were resting. We were resting too, but many of us, that was the last place they couldn't stand up anymore. After a few hours, you heard already the Katyushas and this boom, boom, boom in the background came very fast nearer. And then suddenly the Germans said, we have to come out of the barracks there straight and to march further, to go for a further march. But I was amongst of a few people who couldn't anymore walk anywhere. So, and we were luckily in one of those barracks which were further from the entrance into the. So the Germans, they saw that very few of us came back for further march, and they were afraid they hadn't got enough time to leave. So they actually put fire the nearest few barracks. They were wooden barracks, and they forced out some of those people in the first one, but the fire didn't reach the barrack where we were inside hiding, and so they had to go, and we were left there behind. And a few hours afterwards, the front overran us, and they still reached the other side of the Oder, this last bit of being escorted prisoners. Reached the other side of the river, and the front overran us, and then stopped at the Oder.
So you were liberated at Blackhammer.
At Blackhammer, that's right.
What was the scene when the Russians overran you?
Well, the scene was so that we just suddenly had. I mean, the shooting came nearer and nearer, and then suddenly we heard Russian voices outside, Russian language. So we ran out of the barracks and out of the camp, and that was within minutes and hours, and that was a big, enormous jubilation. And then, I mean, we had to recover first physically. A little bit, because we were totally exhausted, everything, and because the Russians were also still in this fighting move, they were really, it was such a fast advance of the Russian artillery, the order, because the Germans were really retrieving. That was the last defense line they thought they are going to have, which was true. So the Russians were still very badly equipped, but they had not enough food to give to us. So they told us that we can go into the surrounding villages and to try to assemble whatever food that was left in those houses which were left behind after the German fled from there. And so we had food from those houses. I started, we were five of us which we survived it. There were enormous amount of people, of friends and colleagues lying dead around us, but we survived, five of us.
Was there any food in the houses?
No, in this camp was nothing. In the houses there was food there. Still there were potatoes there and some flour and so. And the Russians eventually had one horse which was somehow hurt and couldn't walk anymore properly, so they killed the horse, and so we had a fortnight of horse food, which was also something. It was the first meat after several months. It seems to be unbelievable, but we were just starting a new life. Yes, it was just the liberation, and then it would be again a long story how we lived there. They wanted to evacuate us when the front started, and was staying there for several weeks first. So they wanted to get rid of us because it was still too close to the front, and they didn't want any civil person of unknown quality so close to the front and to all those places. But immediately after a fortnight they were actually there, there came such troops, such Russian troops, and they were starting with there were always soldiers which were either invalids or so, they couldn't actually be fighting on the front. And they came with lorries and started to dismantle this enormous work, this factory where they were making the synthetic petrol. And that was something they wanted to take to Russia. So we said to them, to the commander there, that they should leave us five there, that we still helped them, because if they would have taken us from there into deep Russia somewhere, we would be actually going further from our home, because it was so close to our home already. So I offered myself to do some electrical work for there, and there was one colleague of ours, he was a doctor of chemistry, so he helped to then to dismantle the laboratories there, and so we were working for them, and we lived there, and then they were supplying us with food even till the end of the war, till we survived there. I was actually, because I was repairing radios for the commander, for the Russian commander there, they took out of the houses all radios they left behind the Germans there, and they brought this into such a workshop which I established there, and I was repairing the radios, and the Russian were using this in their barracks. It was for them something, they didn't have any radios. So I was actually one of those few people who heard first, who were listening on the radio, that actually it was the end of the war. It was very, very funny that the commander didn't knew that it's the end of the war. I said to him, I heard some news from the Western radio that it's the end of the war. And then, about after a long discussion, several days afterwards, we persuaded the commander that he took us to Prague with a lorry, which was going with some officers into some place into the Ruhr gebiet, where they should have been getting another such a similar work as a compensation to be dismantled and given to. To Russia, I mean to the Soviet Union at the time. So they diverted a little bit the journey, and they went with the lorry through Prague, and they gave us a lift home back to Prague.
What did you find when you got to your home?
Well, our home in our house, which we had in Rostock, were Germans living, and they were saying they had somehow a Czech connection. They had some. They didn't want to move out. So eventually, the establishment then. There was not a communist establishment at the time. It was normal democratic government there, and they somehow forced them to evacuate the house, and then I moved. It was given, they were giving me a lot of clothing, which was there at the local council there, and they, before I could move into our house back, they gave me some flat, which was empty, where I could live, and that was, then I was waiting whether anybody of my family would return. Unfortunately, my mother, with my sister and with my aunt, were from Auschwitz transported to Belsenbergen, which you might have heard about it. And she, my mother died a day after the liberation through the British Army. She was just one of those thousands there who suffered this terrible typhoid epidemic. And she was just in a coma the day the camp was liberated. And my aunt, she was still not, she didn't quote that, but my sister was also in a coma. But because she was stronger, she survived that. So my sister then later returned, but and my aunt was taken straight from the camp. She was then working there as a translator for the British army there, and then she was taken. My uncle, one of my father's brother, escaped before the war to Britain, and he lived here in Britain, and he took this aunt, his sister, to London, and she married then one officer who helped her in the camp. She befriended then unfortunately must have. I had one message from him into this Blechhammer, into this Javrožno camp when I was still working in the mine, that he is still alive in Auschwitz, because he found again there one so-called prominent in this in the gallery, because he was a writer, he was quite known, and he kept him as a book writer, so-called, there. And he was alive, and he died on this evacuation marsh somewhere in an unknown place. He fell on the way on those hunger marshes which were happening then when the front was wider, so he didn't return to.
One thing that I was going to ask you about the amount of news that you were getting of the war's progress whilst you were in the ghetto and in the camps, did you ever get any big piece of news like Alamein or Stalingrad or D-Day or anything?
Unfortunately, for a long time we had no idea. Only very faint messages came filtered through, as I said, through those people who were working with some civilian. Because in the camp, for example, in the ghetto, there were a few through those connections, as I mentioned, my father had through this person who still had this hidden radio there. He wasn't talking a lot about it with us, because he tried, I mean, you had to read the book in order to see under which condition we were kept there, yes. But then, when we were in the concentration camp, the only thing were we heard through the voice connection who were through Polish civilians. And they were very, we couldn't actually make out. But we knew that the front is already, the Germans are retrieving, and we knew that. We never had a newspaper or something like that.
Did you ever believe that the Germans would win the war?
No, we believed that they would lose. I mean, that was our only hope to survive. So we actually couldn't believe that they would win. I mean, our only hope was that they would lose. They would lose. And when we heard them, they lost somewhere. They lost Stalingrad and things like that, which we heard from those Polish sources, and we heard that they are actually advancing and the Germans are retrieving, then we knew there is something hopeful on the way. So every day we could actually survive was more. We were having the hope that we will survive that. The others who were so weak and they couldn't anymore, they were fighting for food every day, just whatever it was.
Actually, you told me earlier off the record about your repairing the clandestine radio set in the Lodz ghetto. Perhaps you can put it now on the tape, how you asked to do that job.
Yes, one day my father came home. I didn't know that actually he was listening to some news about things which were happening outside in the world. He was afraid that we as children wouldn't be able to keep this secret. And for him, it was just the life to know about those things. And when this place from where his information, actually had what's happening outside in the world, he asked me whether I can keep such a secret and whether I would be willing actually to repair this radio there. And as I said already, I was really, I must admit, I was a terrible coward, and I was really afraid to go there. But the only way, because I knew how important for him it is to have some source of information from outside, so I went with him, and I was lucky to be able to. It was just a resistor which is gone faulty, and he, this chap who had this clandestine radio there, had also some other rest of equipment which wasn't working at all, so I took out this resistor from this 40 instrument, which he kept hiding in a chimney. It was in a chimney which wasn't anymore functional. So I pressed this resistor, and it was working then, and it was all my involvement I had, but it kept my father informed, and he knew then that I know about this, but he never was discussing with me any political news, because he was so afraid that it might filter through somewhere else and to discover this source of his.
Can you say what you remember about how the communist regime arrived in Czechoslovakia in 1948, please?
Yes, well, in this short years after the war, I wasn't really a political animal, but first of all, I was relatively young, and I had to establish myself, and I realized that I'm here on my own, and left actually without parents, and so I was really interested more in to find a good job or to start my career in somehow. So I started to build some electronic equipment, and one day I found myself in the middle of a political campaign because I had an amplifier. It was just after the war, there were very few electronic instruments around. Just we were building this mostly from instruments which were left out of military use. So I built such a powerful amplifier with big speakers, which I recovered from somewhere. And one political movement in this town, little town, asked me whether I would help them when there was this campaign, political campaign for new elections. So I was suddenly in this political movement in a place on the main square and operating this amplifier there for them. So that was my political involvement. Well, I sympathize. It was a nationalist party. It was actually party of President Beneš at the time, which was one of those four. I think it was number three somehow in the election list. I wouldn't give my life for it, but I think it was. And there were, I think, four major parties. There was a Social Democratic Party, then there was an Agrar Party, and then there was the Communist Party and this National Socialist, which was the Czech Benesh Party.
You're going to tell me how the Communists, what your personal memories of how the Communists took over?
Oh, how the Communists have taken over. That was that's known from the history.
But your own personal reminiscence?
My personal the way as I can remember is that suddenly to my somehow disappointment, I didn't know how bad the communism at the time was. I realized that not the party which I supported at this election, at the election, not for political reason, but for the reason that I was asked actually to provide for them this amplifier, which helped to recruit some people there. I was somehow sad that I realized that the communists have won, they gained the majority then. And then when eventually this putsch in 1948 happened, I couldn't do anything. I was just one of those few ordinary people who were just going after my ordinary life, found myself that there is something happening, not actually realizing how bad or what actually it's going to follow after.
What was life like under the communist regime, under Novotny and so on?
Well, it started to be somehow for us very strange. For us who remembered a democracy either before the war or were big enough or were already adults,
after the war, there were still 3 years of new growing democracy again. We couldn't believe it that suddenly we were indoctrinated with something which we couldn't believe that it's true. So we couldn't say the worst thing when we actually were raising our children. We had to confront what the children were coming from school and were taught in the school, which was so untrue, with that what really the truth of the history was, and everything was really distorted. And you had to be so careful not to say anything in front of the children, which would have been filtered again through at school to the teachers, what our point of view it was. When we were not involved in this political process as communists, as long as we were not communists, there was no other way to impress or to put your way of thinking or your political views in it. You know there is something very bad going on, that you were told to do things which were terribly bad, that only those who were actually members of the party were advanced in life. They were becoming directors in factories and wherever. So we knew there is something terribly wrong. And that was the time where we more and more were actually trying to find a way how to live under such circumstances and to survive. And then this Slansky, you might know, terribly discrimination. He was such an idealist of a communist, and when we saw that they sentenced him to death, and so many his fellow people, we saw there must be even within the party something so terribly going on. We couldn't believe it that this discouraged everybody who were really not already involved in the political process to become somehow involved in something which might be a hope for anything better, which unfortunately has happened in 1967, started to be a little bit better, or 66, it was already the first signs. But I was one of those very lucky ones, because I was at the time already working in a research institute, in this, as I mentioned to you, the electroacoustic research institute. And I was chosen to work on this new development of the cinemascope, which was supposed to be installed in Brussels on the Expo of 58. So I was chosen to build it, and then, because I was building, they had no choice to put somebody who was in the party to go to Brussels with it. So till the last moment, I thought I wouldn't be able to go with the machinery there to Brussels, because I was politically clean. And on